At the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C., Sitka, Alaska artist Tommy Joseph is demonstrating his carving technique, making a bear mask, and educating passerby about his work as a Tlingit artist.
Are you making a mask?
I am here. I started this 4 days ago. Okay. It was a solid piece like this. This is going to be a front letter.
For over 30 years, Joseph has traveled the world displaying an art with an intimate connection to his home in Southeast Alaska. I'm Emmett Williams, and today I'm talking to Tommy Joseph about his work, how Tlingit art survived European looting, and how he responds to tourists who ask him about Eskimos. You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, a project of the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I started my conversation with Tommy by asking him where it all began.
I was 8 in the 3rd grade, and a carver, I'm not positive, but I think his name was Stan Morrison, somebody who I've known since I was like 4 days old, but I believe it was him that came to my school. There was a small group, like 5 of us, that got to sit with this carver and make one of what he's making, which was a halibut hook, a wooden fish hook. Two different pieces of wood and a bone barb lashed together with some cordage. So that was my very first carving, and from there I was always drawn towards it, and I started looking at books and going to our local museum and looking at what was around, and any opportunity I had to be around where somebody was doing this sort of work, which wasn't very often then, and if there was, I didn't know where they were. But so anyways, I was doing that, and junior high, I had an art teacher that was really a really good art teacher, and he worked with me and let me come in after school and on weekends to work on different projects in the art room at our school, just because I was, I guess, driven then to want to do everything that I could. I moved down to New Mexico and Oregon, but I always brought, I had a few basic tools with me that I'd made when I was in junior high, and I'd make stuff, whether it was really Northwest Coast or not. I was making stuff just because it's just what I felt driven to do. Find wood wherever, whether it was on a live tree behind my house in Oregon. When I moved back to Alaska, I started working at the Totem Heritage Center, which is run by the city of Ketchikan, City Library or Museum in Ketchikan, and I worked there for a few years as a demonstrating artist and demonstrating carving. When I wasn't up doing my tour, I could sit in the room next, much like I did for the 21 years I was at the Sitka National Historical Park. I sat in a room there as a demonstrating artist and just kept, you know, the more you do it, the better you get.
How does that feel to be doing your art, but also sort of representing the Tlingit people, but also sort of on show for tourists? Where's that line between making sure that you are respecting the traditions and the cultures, but also realize that there's somebody on a cruise ship?
Yeah, well, working at the Sitka National Historical Park for the cultural center that used to be there, and when I was doing that, I was able to make whatever I wanted. So I spent time doing bentwood boxes. That's what I did all season, or other times doing mask carving, and I just focused on different areas and worked on those until I felt that I was ready to move to the next thing and the next thing. But part of my, most of my job was educating the visitors that came through the door. I mean, every now and then I'd have somebody come in and sit down on the chairs so they could relax, because they'd come, either gone out to the park or a spouse would drop them off and they'd go out and then come back later. But just sitting there, and every now and then I'd get them laughing and seeing, because if they just sit there and relax for a bit, and it's a busy day, you know, within 10 minutes I could have you know, a dozen different people walk in and they hear me being asked the same question almost every person that comes through, depending on like what kind of wood is that, how long does it take, things like that. Well, they'll hear the people sitting there listening or watching, observing, we'll see that I answer the same question over and over and over in a short span of time, but I always treat it as it were the first time I heard that question, even though it's the 50th time that morning. just because they're curious people, and I feel, and I don't hold back. I mean, a lot of people come in thinking low man on the totem pole, or you Eskimos, or I mean, I've been how long you Eskimos been carving totem poles? And I stop them there and I have to educate them. Okay, we're from Alaska, but not everybody in Alaska is an Eskimo. We have a lot of different tribes here in the Southeast Alaska, the Tlingit people, which we are. Eskimos didn't carve totem poles, so. Yeah, educating. I have no problem. Straighten them out, tell them how it is, and being straight with them. I think they mostly appreciate that. A lot of people down in the States, what they've been taught or grown up hearing about Native Americans, Alaska Natives, a lot of that information, that what American history have taught them, is wrong. It's the white person's side of the story. Well, if you ask the Native people, I think they're a little more accurate as to telling what really happened, what went down.
Alaska Native art is in collections and museums all over the world starting in the mid-1800s. How did it get there?
Wheel of deal or steal. That's how that went down for all these pieces that are in museums around the world. Just incredible what's out there.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. How did the art leave?
Yeah, usually on a ship. Yeah.
And sometimes it was traded, just like legitimately traded things for that, and sometimes just Europeans just took it.
Yeah. Well, there are a few instances where, okay, it didn't take long for Europeans to figure out when the Tlingit people left their main village where they lived during the different times in the summer when it's time to go harvest fish. The village would pack up and go to their fish camps. And so the way they wrote it down was it was an abandoned village. They came in and they cut down totem poles, took houses. They learned then real quick that they weren't abandoned. They just weren't home. They went to their fish camp for the summer to put up fish for the wintertime. And they just basically came in and looted. And whole houses were gone. And you see totem poles in museums and canoes. I mean, well, that's how a lot of that happened. You can see photos of them posing on the beach, where they have a house stacked up and they have totem poles there and all this loot that they literally just huge piles that posing by their loot that they were getting ready to take and load onto the ship. And
wow.
Yeah.
Was there a period or a decade when there were some people are like, well, I can do this for a living?
Mm-hmm.
And like, when did that happen?
Absolutely. You know, back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, people were bringing it back and relearning the art form. I have a collection of tourist trade totem poles that I am familiar with the artists that have passed away a long time ago, but you can find this stuff out there on eBay or whatever. And I have a small collection of these sort of things, and you can see where the style they were doing wasn't really a traditional style from 100 years earlier. Number one, they have modern paints that they're using, colors that we traditionally didn't have, and just the style that they were making. They were made pretty quickly, a little crudely, and it was they learned a style to accommodate the tourist trade because people were coming up to Southeast Alaska looking for things that they've seen in either on postcards or in old black and white photos.
You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, a project of the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. In the corner of your gallery is this three-piece suit, and I think it's best if you describe it because it's pretty amazing.
Sure. It's a three-piece suit that I actually started design work and working on in Philadelphia at the Fabric Workshop and Museum. Started that 7 years ago. I was invited there, and I didn't. They said you can do whatever you want here. Well, I didn't know what they meant. You can do whatever you want. The fabric workshop. So I'm doing something with fabric, or what am I doing? And so I just said I was going to make a suit with my clan crest design on it. But I had blown the design up with the staff from the fabric workshop. We tried 150%. And it still was too revealing to make this my design because I didn't want it to be evident that it was a wolf and an eagle design on there. So I blew it up to 300%, and every piece was engineered and laid out in a way that my design, like the jacket lined up with the vest underneath and the vest and the pocket. It was an amazing amount of work and trying to find a place that could digitally print my design work onto this fabric was quite an undertaking. It took 7 years to get it, just because of different things that got in our way. We couldn't find a printer that in Philadelphia that could do it, or New York, and so we went to the Netherlands. They printed up 3 suits, and when we got it back to Philadelphia, Eugene the tailor started cutting it out, and there were pieces missing, pieces distorted, and the colors were off, and so that all got scrapped. We ended up going to Italy, where they were successful at printing onto this tropical wool fabric, and I have this tailor-made custom suit that's made to my body with my design work on there. But so they printed up 3 suits there too. And modern day business of today, it's my clan crest on this suit. I could wear this. This suit looks really flamboyant. It's way over the top. I mean, it's not something that I do have to wear it bring it out somewhere at some point. But mostly it's an artist piece that probably will go to a museum one day, but it's you know, the bringing our past to the present of today, our regalia, you know, wearing the robes and the vest and the other pieces that were symbolizing who you were and who your family was, your clan crest on there. I brought it to today's modern world.
Are there people who feel as though this work should not be considered art, that it's disrespectful to show it this way?
For a long time, people have been collecting this sort of stuff. And for a long time, I thought, man, this is sad. You know, all this stuff that was taken way before I was even born, you know, 100 some years ago, are all over the world now, and we hardly have any of our stuff here. I thought it was sad, but then I started thinking about it, and actually, because they were taken, they were bought, traded, sold, stolen, whatever. They're in museums literally around the world. After they'd left here, then missionaries came in and convinced a lot of villages or towns that what they were doing was evil and wrong, and that they needed. And so they had burning piles as the last I heard was in the 70s. They'd get the community out to bring these hundreds of year old artifacts that they weren't considered. They were family members, treasures, and put into a pile and burnt. So had those pieces not gone to out in the world back when they were taken, then a good chance a lot of that stuff wouldn't be around today. So I am thankful that they are there. I mean, I've gone to Europe and Russia, places I would have never gone had they not had our stuff there for me to go do the research and look and learn what I could from these pieces. Because these old pieces, those truly are my teachers. I learned from those and able to go forward with my stuff. We're still here today. We're still doing it. You know, the art for a long time was stifled and put away, but it's not quite the level that, I mean, people are at the level of and beyond. But as far as the everyday use of stuff, it's never gone back to that. I love it when I make a spoon for somebody or a bowl and they actually use it.
To view Tommy's work and to see the suit in person, visit his studio in Sitka, the Raindance Gallery. You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, a project of the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum, with support from the Rasmussen Foundation, the Sitka Legacy Fund, and KCW Sitka. This series is produced by Mission Man Media. Jeff Budd is the executive producer. I'm Emmett Williams, and thanks for listening.